how these things relate to it. So I sort of not, you know, I don't really know what your background is, so you should, I guess, what I'd like to do is get to some of the stuff that is going on. There was sort of a big conjecture that was solved in the last year. So I'll just start with explaining to you a little bit about manifolds and what this question about three manifolds is, and then maybe if I have time, I'll explain a little bit about these cube complexes and maybe what, a little bit about what that has to do with the conjecture. Okay, so manifolds. Do you all know what a manifold is? You learned those, that, right? So what's a manifold, basically? In the language of the streets, what is a manifold? Does anybody want to tell me? Not a formal definition, but just...
Like a subset of Rn, where around each point it kind of looks like Rm.
Right. Okay, so it's a space that looks like Rn. It doesn't need to be actually embedded in any... It's not usually assumed to be embedded in any particular space, but it turns out it's a theorem that it is. So so it's just a... You're meant to imagine some topological space that at every point has a neighborhood that's homeomorphic to Rn. Now, so let's assume also that it's compact. So you want to understand what all these things are. Okay, so just start with the compact. So a one-dimensional compact manifold, who's got one in mind? Just to get things started. This is English, right? So you start here in English. In Hebrew, you start on that side. Okay, so a circle, right? Everybody, that's their favorite compact one-dimensional manifold. It's the only one. Okay, that's a theorem. It's the only one. You can try to think about how you would go about proving something like that. Okay, so that's dimension one. So dimension two, the story is somewhat more complicated. So who's got in mind their favorite compact two-dimensional manifold? The sphere, right? So you, yeah, that's a nice, right? Every point here looks like R2. What else? You got anything in mind for another two-dimensional compact? A torus, right? So this one differs from that one in that there are loops here that can't be contracted to a point. So this space is not simply connected. So this is simply connected. How many of you are familiar? Again, I'm sorry if I'm asking you stupid questions, but notions of simply connected, not simply connected. Have you seen that before? What about the notion of a fundamental group in general? You've seen that? Some have, some haven't. So this space has a loop that you can't contract to a point. It's got another one, you know, maybe this one. It's got many of them. Okay, and in fact, you can describe, you can assign to a space a group. It's called the fundamental group, which records all these different loops, and there's a way of multiplying them and so on. So you get what's called a fundamental group. So this is not simply connected. Okay, and well, anybody got anything else in mind for yeah, there's what's called a projective plane, so I won't, so there's what's called, so these you already can't draw, okay, so there's what's called a S2 RP2, so all right, I don't want to put that as part of my little sequence over here, let me put it here, RP2, okay, so this is the two sphere where, this is a useful thing to think about, where you identify antipodal points. So you all know what a quotient space is. So you can take the two sphere and identify opposite points, and you get still a manifold. Because, you see, you haven't identified points. Within a little neighborhood, you haven't identified points. So in the quotient space, it'll still look like, locally look like R2. Okay, so you can't draw this. It doesn't embed in R3, okay? But it's okay. So this is S2 modulo identifying antipodal points. Okay. What else in sort of something that... So this is a space with a hole, right? You think of that as like a two-sphere where you punch the hole in it. You could also take a two-sphere where you punch two holes in it. Okay, and you get this called a surface of genus 2. So this is genus 2, what's it called? Okay, this is genus 0, 1, 2. Okay, and it's a non-trivial theorem, actually, to prove that this is not homeomorphic to this. Okay, it turns out to be true. I'll tell you a little bit more about that in due course. These guys are what are called orientable. Okay, if you're familiar with that notion, this guy is not. Orientable means that, if you think if you're living in some space, in your two-dimensional space, okay, and you carry with you a pair of normal vectors, okay, that are, you think of like you, here's this way and here's that way, there's x and y. When you go around some loop and you come back, okay, you might have rotated your x and y, right? But if it's non-orientable, then you actually, like in what's called a Möbius band, you will have flipped. Okay, so if you come around and come back, then you have one vector that's pointing in the direction that you're walking along and the other is going like that. When you come back, it's flipped over, so it's pointing that way, right? And this is actually, if you were a bug living in this space, this would be an extremely confusing fact, right? It's as if you take your shoe and you throw it and it comes back, your right shoe, and it comes back as your left shoe. Okay, this would be kind of a very strange thing that happened. And they're very sci-fi things people write about, throw your sandwich and it comes back and you can't eat it because your enzymes can't handle the protein or whatever. Okay, but we don't really want to go there. So there's genus 2, there's genus 3, and there's genus n, okay, and so on. It turns out that's the entire classification up to orientability of compact connected orientable surfaces. Okay, so they all look like one of these beasts over here, and everybody, this is a long known thing. And so somehow you've described them, you see them, you can talk about their fundamental group, whatever that is, okay, and that's well understood as well. There's a little bit of this picture that I want to describe because we'll be taking it later on. There's a notion of a covering space, which is the following. One way to view the torus, so the torus as a quotient of the plane. So think of the Euclidean plane and think of two translations. So you have phi of x and y is x plus 1 y. Okay, so that's a translation in the horizontal direction. And C of xy is xy plus 1. Okay, and that's a vertical translation. And you look at the group generated by those two translations. Okay, so that's a free abelian group of rank 2. Right? And it's acting on the plane. Okay, so if I take any number of these and any number of these, and maybe they're inverses, I'll get one of these translations. And if you think of you want to take R2 modulo the group generated by phi and c. So what does that mean? It means you're going to identify points, okay, that differ, okay, by an integer translation, right? So what points are identified? Well, exactly the points that I've described in this lattice. All of these points are identified to one point, right? Maybe I should use color just because it turned into a multimedia event, right? So all these points are identified to one point, okay? Now, how would we imagine what this quotient really looks like, well, just look at one of these tiles. So every point in the plane has a representative living in this tile, right? Because I can translate it by an integer amount to make it land somewhere in here, right? And if we focus just on this tile, what identifications do I make? Well, I identify a point here with, say, a point here, right? And a point there with a point there, right? And similarly, in this direction, you identify, right, I'll say a point over here with a point over here, right, and so okay. So the quotient, and inside here I don't identify anything, right? Okay, so everybody can see that at least locally over here, the quotient's going to be a manifold, right? And if I think of a neighborhood of this point over here, I zoom in on this. What will a neighborhood of that look like? Well, it'll be a half a disk from here and a half a disk from here that are glued together, right, to give also, okay, a point, a neighborhood that looks like R2, right? So this quotient space is a manifold, and it's in fact the torus. This one pink point is here. These two loops become, these two lines project to loops like this, okay, and the rest of it, so you think of it, it's like a carpet, like you roll a carpet, an infinite one, right, to get a cylinder, to get an infinite cylinder, and then you roll that infinite cylinder to get this torus. Does that make sense, at least on an intuitive level? I mean, okay? So that's a description. This is what's called a covering space. The map from here to here is called a covering map. And why is it called a covering map? Well, there's a definition. Every point here has a little neighborhood such that the pre-image of that neighborhood is a bunch of disjoint copies of the same thing. Okay? Every point here is a little neighborhood. The pre-image is, it's a little disk, and the pre-image is a bunch of disjoint disks. So locally, it's a homeomorphism. Okay? And there's going to be, it's a theorem that there's a group acting up here, which is z squared, and in fact, that group will be the fundamental group of this space. That's the theorem. That's non-trivial if you haven't learned that. It's okay. So that's just a bit of the picture that happens in dimension 2. And if you go look at these guys, okay, it turns out they have a very similar description, but not with the Euclidean plane, but with something else called the hyperbolic plane, which people learn about less for some reason. You learn Euclidean geometry, but you don't learn hyperbolic geometry in high school, but maybe they should teach it. But, you know, you have the interior of a disk. It's a geometry. It's a fascinating geometry. The interior of this disk, the unit disk, and lines in this space aren't straight lines like you're used to thinking. They're arcs of circles that are perpendicular to the boundary. So this boundary is not in my space. Okay, it's called the celestial circle. I actually call it that. And these are straight lines. And there's actually a metric, a distance you can put on this disk where these minimize distance between two points. So these are the straight lines between points. And what you can do is you can show that you can actually tile this space, just instead of tiling it with squares, you tile it with these kind of octagons that look like this. Okay, the odds that I'll draw something with eight sides are small, but that's okay. Okay, just pretend that there are eight sides here, where the angles here are all actually 45 degrees. And you might have seen these like Escher-type drawings, right, where things get smaller and smaller as you go out to these things. These things are universal covers of surfaces of genus bigger than one. Okay? It's a description of these things. So there is a very rich theory in which surfaces can be described in this way. There's a group acting here, just like Z plus Z was acting in this very simple way over here. Okay? These groups are what are called Fuchsian groups. And there's every element, just like in the plane, elements are either translations or they're rotations. Okay, and you can understand a lot about surfaces from understanding this picture of them as a quotient of the hyperbolic plane by discrete, what are these called? Discrete group actions on the hyperbolic plane. Okay? So this was something that was sort of understood already, say, in the 19th century, late 19th century, people understood this kind of a picture. So that's surfaces in 10 minutes. You know, you can spend an entire semester just studying surfaces and their different hyperbolic structures. But what I wanted to tell you about was free manifolds, because in dimension 4 and higher, there's somehow no hope of really understanding or classifying in any sensible way all the manifolds in the same way that we've described here, where there's a nice simple list and so on. There are theorems that tell you that in dimension 4 there isn't a good way to do that. But in dimension 3, somehow there was an attempt to do the same thing, and it's a somewhat more complicated story, and I'm not going to tell you all of it. But let's just talk about what are some three-dimensional manifolds. So three-manifold theorists, you know, they want to know what they all are. What are, just like we wrote down that list of surfaces, what are all three-dimensional manifolds? So what's one that you can think of? So, yeah, you can talk about the... well, first of all, there's R3, but that's not compact, right? But there is S3. So S3 sitting inside of R4. Right? This is the set of all x, y, z, such that x squared plus y squared plus z squared is equal to 1. Oh, sorry. There's a W, because it's the 3 sphere in R4. So you can't imagine it anymore, right? With the 4 dimensional thing. But that's a 3 dimensional manifold. Okay, you can convince yourself, it's not entirely trivial, but that every point has a neighborhood that looks like R3. Okay? And in fact, you can cover it with just two neighborhoods, just like you do with a 2-sphere. Okay? So that's one manifold. People knew about this guy, but there are others. So let's look at, this is one example here. Another example is S1 cross S1 cross S1. Okay, so this locally looks like R cross R cross R. Okay? This should remind you of which of the two manifolds that we talked about, the two-dimensional manifolds we talked about earlier? The torus. So this is called the three-dimensional torus. Okay? And you could view it in different ways. You can also you can view it in the same way as you viewed this. Okay? So it's R3 modulo, let me just write Z3. So three different translations. Okay, you go the x direction, you go in the y direction, you go in the z direction. You take three translations. That gives you a group. A group generated by those three guys is z cross z cross z. You identify points, okay? And now, instead of, you know, like this picture is like all the computer games you play, right? Everybody plays games on the torus, right? You know, you go here and you come out here and you go there, and right? So here it's like you would be playing a game in this three-dimensional torus. You'd be flying around and come back to the same point and in these three different parameters, x, y, and z. Okay, so this guy doesn't embed in R3, but he's a nice three-dimensional manifold. So this is the three torus. Another way to think about it, besides this this covering space, which is R3, just like here, this is called the universal covering space, is to think about the following. You can take a torus cross an interval, okay? An interval, let me just write 0, 1. Okay, so that's just a nice thickening of the torus. It's a three-dimensional space. But it's got this boundary, right? This points on this boundary over here don't have neighborhoods that look like R3, right? Because they're sort of like half of R3. But you can fix that by gluing the top to the bottom. Everybody see that? So you get this space that's... doesn't embed in R3, so it's difficult to draw, but... heuristically, it's something like this, right? It's a circle's worth of tori. Okay. Okay. This what's intriguing about three-manifold topology is you can almost picture. It's not like this abstract thing, you know. When you learn like Hilbert space is some infinite-dimensional thing, so you get used to working with it. It's okay, but here it's like you can almost picture it. Okay, so. That's one type of three-dimensional manifold that people knew about. You can actually generalize this picture by constructing other examples, which is the following. Take some surface of genus, maybe not one, but two or three or more. And again, take this surface, cross 0, 1. Okay, and now identify the top and the bottom. Okay, so you can identify the top and the bottom, but not necessarily. So, you know, you take S cross 0, 1 modulo, where you identify x comma 0. You want to identify it with. Normally, you would what we did there is you just identify it with x comma 1, and we get this exact same picture that we have here, right? A circle's worth of surfaces, but you see, you could take a homeomorphism of the surface to itself, and it turns out there are many interesting non-trivial homeomorphisms of the surface to itself. And instead of identifying x0 with x1, you identify it with f of x1. Okay, and then you get a different kind of a space. You get a space that's called a vibration over the circle. So you get, again, a picture that looks kind of like this. So there's a circle's worth of these surfaces, but when you go back and you come around, you start with a point here. When you go back and you come around, you'll maybe end up at a different point. Okay, you keep going and you'll end up at a different point. Then it's kind of a more complicated manifold. So this is a way of making this one very simple example of R3 modulo Z3, the three torus that we all know and love by now, right? To something more complicated. This is called a vibration over circle. And there were many other constructions that people had of three manifolds, and there were many questions that they wanted to answer about these guys. For example, you'd like to know there is this. You'd like to know whether, for example, all of these three manifolds, these compact three manifolds that aren't the three sphere, okay, and aren't finite quotients of the three sphere, you'd like to know that you can obtain them by taking R3 modulo some group acting on them in some way. Okay? And it's not exactly, there's a notion of what's called an irreducible manifold. I won't get into that. But that was a big conjecture. People wanted to know the universal covers under suitable conditions is always R3. Okay? Maybe not a Euclidean space. Maybe it'll be some kind of hyperbolic space okay, with some other geometry or some other beast. But topologically, it should be R3, and there should be a group acting there, and the quotient will be that. Or maybe there's some kind of wild and crazy things that people wouldn't know about. They wanted to know, for example, in terms of the fundamental group, and again, I haven't defined it, so I don't want to discuss it too much, but whether there's what's called a solvable word problem. So this is a group which turned out to have a finite presentation. They wanted to know whether there's some algorithm for determining whether a loop was the trivial loop. So if I gave you a loop that inside of the space, is there an algorithm to decide if it's the trivial loop? And various other questions. And these were all dealt with in the 1960s by two people named Hocken and Waldhausen. So they introduced a notion of what was later called a Hocken manifold, which is a manifold that has in it an interesting surface. Okay, so what do I mean by that? So, Hocken manifolds. So, a three-dimensional manifold is Hocken. So here's my picture of a three-manifold. It's the best I can do. It's called Hocken if I have a surface embedded in it. These are the pictures that three-manifold theorists always draw. This is a surface embedded inside of a three-manifold. Okay? Such that every loop on this surface, which is non-trivial on the surface, so not something like this, but something like that, if it's non-trivial on the surface, I can't contract it to a point on the surface, then I can't contract it to a point in the space. Okay? So that's called an incompressible surface. So every point, every loop which is non-trivial. Non-trivial means can't be contracted to a point. Non-trivial on the surface is non-trivial in the manifold. Okay, so this is an interesting surface. Why do I call this an interesting surface? Because in R3 there's a surface right here. This picture that I drew here, you can just imagine a surface like that embedded in R3, right? Now in R3 every loop can be contracted to a point, right? So all of these non-trivial loops on the surface can be contracted to a point in R3. Okay? And since a three-manifold, every point has a neighborhood that looks like R3, I can put lots of these stupid surfaces in them, right? So if you gave me any three-manifold, there's a little neighborhood that looks like R3. There it is, the little ball. I can just put a surface there. And that would be uninteresting because there are tons of them. So I'm not going to learn anything about a three-manifold by this. But these guys, they're very different, okay? And if you think of these examples I gave you earlier, these guys here, these are incompressible. When I take a surface across a circle, like here, like a torus across a circle, this torus over here, every loop on it, which is non-trivial, you can't contract to a point inside the space. Then you have to prove that. It's not entirely trivial, but okay? So that's the picture. These guys have incompressible surfaces, so do these guys. And lots of three-manifolds do. And so they said, okay, let's invent this notion, Hocken 3. And they were able to prove many questions. So this is in the 1960s. So a manifold is called, three-manifold is called Hocken if it has one of these beasts. And they knew that there were lots of them. And then they were able to prove lots of things about three-manifolds. So good things happen. I'm not going to go through a whole okay, we could talk for another 2 hours about all the theorems they proved in the 60s about these things. Okay? But when you had these surfaces, they could then cut along these surfaces, separate into two pieces, then find more surfaces inside them and cut them up, and then it was an inductive procedure. There was sort of a way of a method of proof that allowed you to do many, many good things. Okay, so far so good. And what this definition is, I mean, if you haven't seen a lot of this stuff, then, or don't know what fundamental group it's, maybe not so natural, but I hope at least I can convince you that there are many examples of these kinds of surfaces inside of three manifolds. Okay? Okay, so so unfortunately for these two guys and for other people that were around the 60s thinking about three manifolds, there are non-Hockin three manifolds. And they knew then that there were some examples of non-Hockin three manifolds. So unfortunately, or, you know, maybe not so unfortunately, makes life more interesting, there exists non-Hockin compact three manifolds. Okay, so, and they were, Hockin and Waldhausen themselves were aware of this. I won't describe them for you. There are certain types of what are called ciphered fibered spaces, very simple spaces that they knew about. But they were, you know, since they were unhappy about this, they said, well, okay, maybe I won't get to do that, but that maybe every three manifold besides the three-sphere, and I owe you another definition that I'm not giving you, so it's a slight lie, but maybe every three-manifold is finitely covered by a Hockin three-manifold. And so what does that mean? If you, I told you what a universal cover is, right, when you have a torus is a quotient of a plane. Well, there are other covering spaces that you can construct. So let's go to dimension one. There's a circle, right? And just like the plane, the torus was a quotient of the plane by two translations. This is a quotient of the real line, right, by a translation, right? So you just take one translation. You know, x goes to x plus 1, and that's phi. Right, that's phi of x is x plus 1. And you look at the group generated by phi, and then the real line modulo phi, the group generated by phi, is the circle, right? Just like with the torus. Okay, but besides that, you could take, for example, a map of the circle to the circle that rotates by 2 pi over 3, and get a map from the circle to the circle. That's a covering space. Everybody see that? So this is multiplication by 3 if you're viewing the circle as sitting inside the complex plane, the unit circle. So you see that every point here, every point has 3 pre-images, right? And then every point, if you look at a small enough neighborhood, will have these 3 sort of disjoint neighborhoods over here, right? Okay, everybody see that? So this is called a finite covering space. You sort of unwrap, here you unwrap your space completely. This is the language of the streets in three manifold theory. This is, you unwrap your manifold. Okay, so here you unwrap the circle and got, but not completely, like here you completely unwrap it to get the real line. Here you unwrap it finitely. Every point has finitely many pre-images in the circle. And in the torus, you can do the same thing. You can unwrap it. Let's say these are the two two loops that you think of in the torus, you can unwrap it in one direction. So maybe, I'm not a very good artist, but yeah, okay, let's do this. And okay, so one of the loops, let's give it some color. This loop here, this pink one, is unwrapped twice. So you get one there and one there. Okay, everybody see that? Beautiful artistry. You think of this bagel over here. Imagine spinning it by 180 degrees. Okay, and then you've identified this circle with that circle and this point with that point and so on. Right? And you can do the same thing in the other direction, right, and get more and more covering spaces. In fact, to every subgroup of Z squared, it turns out there's a one-to-one identification between subgroups of Z squared and covering spaces. Okay? And these covers that I'm describing here are finite covering spaces. You somehow slowly unwrap your manifold. And so what they were saying here, these guys, this is a conjecture of Bockhausen. So this guy here, he didn't say maybe, you know, you call it a conjecture, right? This is Waldhausen from 1968, maybe. That every three manifold is finitely covered by a Hockin three manifold. It's not quite right. You need to say irreducible, which I didn't define for you here, but let's skip that part of the story. Okay, so you'd like to know that somehow you might have these manifolds that you couldn't find these surfaces like this in them because they were too small, but you could unwrap them, and in that unwrapping, there would be such a guy. And then all the good things that happen that I didn't tell you about here, turns out they would happen there too. So they say, okay, you know, we got kind of in trouble over here with these existence of these non-Hockin manifolds. And in fact, the examples they knew that were non-Hockin were called virtually Hockin. This is called virtually. If you have a finite cover that's blah, then you say that it's virtually blah. Okay, that's in the language of three manifolds. Okay, so that's what finitely covered by a Hockin three manifold. So everybody happy so far? So good on what? And then what happened is that Bill Thurston arrived on the scene in three manifold theory in the 70s. And he had this vision that what's guiding three-manifold topology is hyperbolic geometry, just like in dimension 2. Remember I told you earlier that, you know, the surfaces of these genus 2 are covered by the hyperbolic plane, which is usually called H2, and H2 modulo some group, some discrete group, which is acting. And remember, there were these cool octagons that you could then tile the plane with, okay, the hyperbolic plane with, and all these surfaces were obtained as quotients of the hyperbolic plane by these guys. Said, well, in three dimensions, that's true also. Okay, that was his sort of guiding light. And so Thurston somehow says that most, and I won't, compact three manifolds, can be obtained as hyperbolic three space modulo gamma, where this is a discrete group acting on the hyperbolic three space. Okay, and there are many sort of cool pictures you could draw here, which, you know, I can't draw, you know. I could have made it more a multimedia event and showed you some of these cool pictures, but there are these dodecahedra. So everybody has in their mind a dodecahedron, right? So you can have these dodecahedra that look like this. They're sort of more spiky. They're built out of pieces of spheres, kind of, okay? The little polyhedra that, and the dihedral angle over here is pi over 4. And then you can tile all of hyperbolic 3 space by these guys and obtain these interesting quotients. And these examples, people, before Thurston came along in the 70s, this is 1970s, people knew of a few examples. They knew this thing and they knew a few others. And he was able to prove that most of them, so in some generic sense, 3 manifolds are typically typically H3 modulo gamma. That was kind of an amazing event. And in fact, he was able to show that it turns out that his work and other people's work, so together with, there's also what's called Perlman. I'm not telling you anything about that because there's just too much to say here. Tells you that if you want to solve this conjecture, it's enough to solve it for these hyperbolic manifolds. Okay, so these other complications that arise because not all 3 manifolds are hyperbolic don't matter, okay, for the perspective of this conjecture. So if you want to prove that they're all virtually Hockian, you can do it for these things. And then Thurston asked the following question. He didn't state it as a conjecture. So the following question: is every hyperbolic 3 manifold virtually, so as a finite cover, virtually a fibration over the circle? So getting back to this example that we talked about earlier, I described for you how you can build examples of 3 manifolds that are obtained by taking a surface across an interval and identifying opposite sides. Remember, I drew these vibrations that we talked about. They're very simple constructions. And he was able to show that some of them were hyperbolic. They said, well, maybe they all are. Maybe every one of these guys that people had many examples of were actually finitely covered by this, not just virtually Hockian. This was called the virtual fibering question. So he, in the same paper that he wrote this, he wrote something like, this dubious sounding question has a definite chance of a positive answer. Okay, that's called hedging your bets. All right. Okay, and so it was indeed dubious sounding. When I was a kid growing up, the word on the street was that the virtual Hockian conjecture is going to be true. I mean, people had ideas for why it should be true. It seemed to be true. And this is going to be false. There's no way that all 3 manifolds, hyperbolic 3 manifolds, they had all these computer programs that could construct, you know, lots and lots of interesting hyperbolic 3 manifolds, that they're going to be just these vibrations over the circle, albeit these were complicated. So that's why Thurston was, he's not a stupid guy, had good reason to think that this is a reasonable question to ask. But still, people didn't really believe this. And in 2010, so this is not that long ago, Donnie Wise showed that the two questions are equivalent. So the word on the street was wrong. So nobody didn't at that stage know whether it was true or false. But if everything's virtually Hawken, then everything's virtually fiber. And that was kind of an amazing thing. I think at that time, very few people thought that it was right. There must be something wrong, because this can't be true. And then only recently, 2012, Abel, relying on work of Wise, showed that that both are true. Okay, so both are in fact true. So every one of these guys has a finite cover, which is a fibration. Now, so in the last 15 minutes, I'm going to tell you a little bit about how this was proven. And it's an extremely complicated story. This, like, you know, the Wise's work was developed over about 15 years, and the main paper that he wrote there is maybe 180 pages long. And Egel then built on that to prove this virtual fibering. So I'm certainly not going to tell you, going to give you the proof in 15 minutes. But the interesting thing is that I think that's the interesting kind of lesson that I'd like to tell you, is that it came from somewhere else entirely. So it wasn't constructing covers of three manifolds, it was constructing something completely different, a different kind of space. So so these were what are called CAD0 cube complexes. Okay, and CAD0 cube complex is just like, you know, this floor. So you take, you get yourself a bunch of cubes. So you take unit Euclidean cubes. Okay, you get yourself a bunch of them of different dimensions, whatever dimensions you like, but they have to be one by one, right? And maybe you've got some three cubes. Okay, and once you've placed your order for these cubes, and when they arrive, you start gluing them together in some way, like blocks. Okay, but you're only allowed to glue them by isometries of their faces. So when you build these things, maybe you'll get yourself your three cube and you glued it to these three squares are glued to each other along an edge. Maybe a three cube is glued there. Maybe you now have some edge that you attach in this way. Maybe another edge that you attach here, and so on. Okay, you build some kind of a complex. Okay? For those of you that are familiar, it's like a simplicial complex. You take simplices, except here you use cubes, okay, blocks, and you build them together. And there is what's called a non-positive curvature condition. So this guy here is what's called a cube complex. And there's a notion of non-positive curvature. So I won't, again, to save time, I'm not going to give a formal definition. But just if you think about squares, if you were to take a bunch of squares, just dimension 2, what you're not allowed to do is you're not allowed to glue less than 4 squares around a vertex. So you're not allowed to glue 3 squares like so. Okay? That's bad. Okay? And for those of you that are familiar with the kind of normal notions of curvature, you can see that you have less than 2 pi around this vertex, so it sort of feels like positive curvature, right? There's a little cone point there, right? So it feels like positive. If you have 4 or more, if you have 4, it's flat like this plane, right? And if you have 5 or more, it's already kind of like a saddle, right? If you tried to glue five squares around a vertex, it would feel like negative curvature. Okay, so there's this combinatorial notion of non-positive curvature. You're also not allowed to glue two squares like, you know, this. This would be even worse, right? That would mean that you have, right, pi around this vertex. It's not even like this 3 pi over 2. So these two things are bad. So you rule out certain things. You don't let yourself do certain things. And if you don't let yourself do that, then you've built a non-positively curved cube complex. And if it's also simply connected, then you call it a cat zero cube complex. That has a long history going back to Cartan, Alexandrov, and Tapanagov. But we won't go there. And the amazing thing is that it turns out that if you have a three manifold, you can it may not have a hyperbolic three manifold may not have one of these embedded surfaces, but it'll have in it lots and lots of immersed incompressible surfaces. Okay, so this is a theorem. It's a long story, but of Kahn and Markovitch from 2009 is that hyperbolic three manifolds have many, and again, we don't have time for formalisms, but many immersed incompressible surfaces. And that's that was very hard work. Okay, this was a theorem in ergodic theory, actually. It was quite a tour de force. And once there were lots of these surfaces, it turns out that you can build, okay, so there's a construction. So you can build a cat zero cube complex. And your original group, which was the fundamental group of your manifold, your gamma will act on this space, and x modulo gamma is non-positively curved cube complex. It may be of dimension a million. Okay? Okay, so this is something that I did when I was a little kid. But it turns out that you can use this here now, because this million-dimensional cube complex, you'd think, well, what have I gained? I had a three-manifold. Well, because they're cubes, it's easier to cut along them and build covers. So people didn't know how to build finite covers where a thing like this, like one of these immersed surfaces, would unwrap to an embedding. Right? People knew you could unwrap hyperbolic three manifolds, but you didn't know that when you unwrapped them, you would unwrap these surfaces. And the amazing thing is that by using these cube complexes, people were able to show that you could not just the surfaces, but many other type of objects sitting inside your space, you could unwrap inside these finite covers. And once you've done it for these non-positively curved cube complexes, you go back and you say, well, I can do it for my original manifold. So there was a detour in this proof, which went through an entirely different field. People working, I don't know how to explain this exactly, but sort of working with their bare hands to build these finite covers by cutting cube complexes along, you know, things like this. You see this cube right there that's in the middle of this thing. You can cut along these things, open it up, and glue them back together. And that's a very simplistic version of the story. But that's something you could do here that you couldn't do in the hyperbolic three-manifold to begin with. So there's much to say about this whole tale over here. But I just wanted to give you a little bit of a flavor of how sometimes a question that's been sort of sitting around in one field, people go and translated into a problem in a completely different area, and there things become simpler, even though you wouldn't think it would. Right here, you suddenly have a million-dimensional manifold, how would cube complex, how would you solve things there? Well, it turns out that there you can. Okay, so I think I'll stop there.